You actually said that before.
Hey, Mitch. We need a topic. Can I, Mitch?
2820.
We have two quick work sessions. House Committee on Energy and Environment will come to order. Colleagues, today is February 26th. We have a busy agenda today. We are going to start by opening a work session on House Bill 2472. Adam?
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, House Bill 2472 extends the sunset for renewable energy resource manufacturing from January 1st, 2014 to January 1st, 2020. A revenue statement has been issued. There is no fiscal impact.
And am I correct in that it has a subsequent referral?
Yes, it does. I'm sorry about that. It is going over to JTAX.
Okay, so we're going to need to add that as part of the motion.
Actually, it's already.
Representative Boone, do you have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the -4 amendment stated. Whoops, wrong bill, sorry. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2472 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Boone moves House Bill 2472 with a due pass recommendation and I believe to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits by prior reference. It was in here, I think, on the script.
Okay.
Is that correct,
script
President Boone?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Is there further discussion? Is there objection to the motion? Motion carries, and it is on its way to its next committee. Close the work session on House Bill 2472. Open a work session on House Bill 2820. Adam?
House Bill 2820 requires the Oregon Department of Energy to conduct a study of solar energy facilities required to have site certificates and review effectiveness of public health and safety provisions related to solar energy facilities. It requires a study on the on recommendations to be reported to interim committees by November 1st, 2013, declares an emergency effective on passage. The -4 amendment replaces the measure. It defines arable and non-arable lands, adds solar thermal power plants to the energy facility list, requiring an energy facility siting council approval, increases acreage allowable on non-arable land to site solar photovoltaic energy facilities before requiring FSEC approval, declares an emergency is effective on passage. It has a subsequent referral currently to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. It has no revenue impact nor a fiscal impact.
Colleagues, our plan on this, as you may remember, the testimony House Bill 2440, this is the replacement because of the relating to clause. We set the acreage limitation at a section at 640 acres. I think we are ready to work this bill. There are a couple more questions around some of the details of the land use implications of that. That is, I believe, better handled by the Land Use Committee than by this committee. Hence, we will be rescinding the referral to Ways and Means and adding the referral to land use as was on 2440.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the -4 amendments dated February 25th, 2013.
Representative Boone moves to adopt the -4 amendments. Is there any discussion? Any objection to the -4s? Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2820 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a request that the subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded and that it be referred to the House Committee on Land Use.
Vice Chair Boone moves House Bill 2820 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and requests that the subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded and that it be referred to the House Committee on Land Use. Is there any discussion? Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think this is a small step for Eastern Oregon, but a large step for the Willamette Valley. So I appreciate it, and hope that at some point we can revisit it. But this is a good thing, so I'll be supporting the bill.
Thank you, Representative. Seeing no further discussion, is there objection to the motion? Seeing none, motion carries, and it's on its way. and close the work session on House Bill 2820. And we're going to start with an informational meeting, colleagues. That'll come out of land use, I believe. We're going to open an informational meeting and invite up Megan Butler from Recology. Colleagues, I want to note that we've had some bills move around on the scheduling because of timing. We've invited Recology and after them Columbia Biogas to be here today to discuss an update on some of the things that they've been working on unrelated to any of the other subjects before this committee today. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Bailey, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Megan Butler, and I'm with Recology's Landfill and Organics Division. And my colleague here is Amy LeCoque. She's our Group Environmental Manager for the Northwest Region. This afternoon, my presentation will be discussing how Recology is partnering with Oregonians and how we wish to continue to create and enhance more partnerships throughout the state in order to develop innovative and sustainable recycling solutions. First, I'd like to give you a little bit of background about Recology. We are a 100% employee-owned company. We are a vertically integrated resource recovery company where we provide collection, sorting, processing, and marketing of discarded materials in order to create new products. In Oregon, Recology owns and or operates 16 different operations, which you can see indicated by these blue dots on the map over here. These range from transfer stations, material recovery facilities, compost facilities, collection companies, just to name a few. These Recology Oregon operations employ about 249 Oregonians. As a true resource recovery company, we believe in our tagline, Waste Zero. We do not own or operate any landfills in the state, so our interests do not lie in disposal. They do lie in recycling. So that means that it goes beyond just diverting those materials from landfills. It's important to view these discarded materials as resources and put them to their highest and best use. With this being our business model, it allows us to promote and advocate for social responsibility and sustainability, not only through recovering these materials, but also through empowering people to do the same. This business model of Recology's is aligns with Oregon policy. These Oregon values also advocate for public awareness and participation. You know, this goes to show that Recology actively participates in creating and enhancing these types of movements. That's why Recology has decided to make some long-term commitments to doing business in the state. It is because Oregon has made this commitment to move towards living sustainably. And this is because they see the importance in not only reduce, reuse, recycle, but about looking at the bigger picture and reducing greenhouse gases and upstream impacts. I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the recycling numbers in the United States. This pie chart here is from the US EPA on 2010 total municipal solid waste generation. It shows the material that was generated and the percent of the total waste stream. This next pie chart shows the percent recovered by weight of each of those materials. There's a couple points I'd like to make about these charts. The first is being that yard trimmings makes up one of the largest recovery rates of all the materials in the United States. That being said, food scraps makes up almost 14% of what's generated, but has one of the lowest recovery rates in the state at 2.8%. Moving on, I'd like to look at the difference between the United States recovery rates and that of the state of Oregon. Clearly, you can see that Oregon is a leader in recycling, where it outshines the national average by almost 20%. This 52.3% recovery rate was a record high for the state of Oregon and surpasses the 50% recovery goal that was a statewide goal. This is largely because of the rigorous recycling programs and new composting programs that the state has implemented. With that being said, there's also room to grow on this. Looking at that overall number and back to the pie chart that I showed you earlier, we are able to see where that low-hanging fruit lies, kind of, for lack of a better word, where you can get that bang for your buck, where you can easily capture more types of materials that have a bigger impact in increasing your recycling rates. Most noticeably, this is food scraps and other organics. However, in order to capitalize on this low-hanging fruit, there needs to be incentives and investments in infrastructure in order to do this. To Recology, that means investing in the facilities as well as the communities in which we operate. For example, we've just invested nearly $5 million in our North Plains facility. We've rebuilt our subtle rolled our Sewell Road Materials Recovery Facility, as well as finish several large construction jobs at our Almsville composting facility, all in order to accept and better handle more types of materials. This is also in an effort and in hopes and anticipation that surrounding communities want to continue to invest in increasing their recycling and implement more programs. Another way that you need to handle to be able to capture this low-hanging fruit, such as composting, yard waste, and most more importantly, food waste, is you need to work with companies of innovations. Recology was one of the first of its kind to create a three-bin collection system where you have the black for garbage, the blue for recycling, and the green for organics. This drastically increases recovery rates by source separating those materials. It's also important that these companies of innovations like Recology believe in investing in the right type of technology that will be able to handle these more and different types of materials that are going to be coming through the waste stream. Another piece of this puzzle is to ensure that you have the right network of customers and partnerships in order to complete that circle. For Recology, that network of customers includes Oregon agriculture, wineries, government entities, landscaping, just to name a few. These network of partners include schools, libraries, gardens, fire stations, as well as an art program initiative that we did in partnership with Metro called Glean. And then the very last part of this puzzle is taking pride in the areas in which you live and work and investing in the communities that surround you. So to Recology, that means using local vendors and resources whenever possible and practical. Clearly, Oregon is a leader in conserving resources through recycling and the proper materials management. It's time that we view these discards not as waste, but as resources. So the next horizon is not going to be a part of the waste management paradigm, but of the materials management paradigm. And Oregon has already taken huge steps in becoming a leader in this field. The Oregon document vision for 2050 of materials management, which was just created by DEQ and approved by the EQC, is an example of these policy and programs that Oregon hopes and intends to move forward on. These types of public policies make a difference. They are the signals from the legislature that point the way for private companies like Recology to have the confidence to invest in the new technology, but it's also what guides and encourages changes in public behavior, such as source separation, using resources wisely, generating waste only as necessary, and finding ways to use those discarded products in a way that not only benefits the environment, but also people. So though Recology is a private company, we work a lot with government and really value our public-private partnerships, because without these partnerships, neither Recology as a company nor the communities that we serve can reach those ever-increasing recycling and recovery rate goals. So it's the strong leadership in Oregon and the endorsement of recycling initiatives or policies, whatever they may be, from reuse efforts to composting facilities, anaerobic digestions, future technologies that we don't even know exist yet, that will enable the state and its citizens to continue this path towards their sustainability efforts and sustainable future. You know, with that, Recology would really like to applaud what the state has already done and what they continue to work on, and really look forward to continuing to work with you in future efforts that will increase the recovery goals. With that, I'd like to open it up to you, Chair, and the committee members for any questions.
Great. Thank you very much for the presentation. Committee members?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Wheeler, are you going to recycling pickup for rural areas?
I think that depends on our partnerships with those specific areas as they want to roll out those programs.
I'm sorry, could you introduce yourself?
Yes, I'm sorry. My name is Amy LeCocq. I'm the Group Environmental Manager for Oregon.
Thanks.
So it's the partnerships that we have with those areas, and when they choose to roll out those programs, then we'll hopefully be at the table and be a partner with them. So,
great. Representative Reardon.
Well, first of all, I'd like to commend you for the amount of work that you are doing to manage our waste, and I appreciate that. My only concern is the potential impact on the neighborhoods in which your facilities are located, and I'd like to hear a little bit more about how you work with the communities, specifically Lentz community.
And if I could add to your question, Representative, if you could talk a little bit about some of the regulations that your facilities are under as well, that would be great.
Thank you.
Well, in specific to the Lentz community, we've worked with Metro as well as DEQ and the public to try and bring some clarity to the project. A lot of misconception had happened at the beginning of the project, where people felt that, you know, it was a compost facility coming into an industrial area next to a neighborhood. So we held several public meetings, informational meetings, forums where people could come and talk about their concerns, and we could specifically address those concerns in our project. And we made several. That project hasn't been executed yet, but we've made several changes to how we would operate that facility were it to be built. That would specifically address the public's concerns, odor control measures. That facility would be a reload facility, but it would actually be enclosed indoors with measures that actually aren't even required at transfer stations for odor control. So we would be going above and beyond what's existing at transfer stations for that facility. Also, we've talked about a good neighbor agreement, and we've tried to work with the Lentz neighborhood on completing that agreement. So for that specific facility, those are some measures that we've taken.
And in other areas, we also take a lot of pride in trying to listen to what our surrounding community has to say, to bring them on tours, to educate them about what it is that they're trying to do and how they're part of the process, as well as take any of their suggestions on how they see that we can improve our facilities or what they would like to see us do in the community. And Amy, being our group environmental manager, can speak a little bit to the types of regulations that we adhere to in both, transfer stations as well as composting facilities.
Right. So all those facilities that we talked about, the compost facilities, the reloads, those have solid waste permits with DEQ, as well as, we need to comply with the land use if it's a non-conforming use, or if we have a land use permit as well. If we're in the metro region, then we have a metro license as well. So there are several layers of regulations that we need to adhere to, and we take pride in working with those regulators and really partnering with those agencies so that we can be at the forefront of compliance rather than trying to play catch up.
Representative Johnson.
Oh, sorry, did you have a follow-up?
Just a question on it. I have no doubt that you're doing everything possible to make this a acceptable project for the neighborhood, so I appreciate that. Does your work involve traffic impacts specifically?
Yes, actually, for the Lentz facility in particular, we did two separate traffic studies for that proposed operation. For the Suttle Road expansion, there was a traffic study done, and those were things that we did throughout the land use process prior to even going forward with the operational permits to ensure that if we did take that extra step to go for the operational permits, that we wouldn't be negatively impacting the neighborhoods that we exist in.
Johnson. Thank you,
Mr. Chair. As someone who represents part of Oregon outside of Metro Portland and the I-5 corridor, forgive my ignorance, but what is so harmful about having yard debris in a landfill environment? Seems to me like it would be a pretty biodegradable type product in fairly short order compared to other things.
Certainly, that's a good question. It is. However, the landfill space is better used for materials that can't be turned into a recycled material, and yard debris, the best and highest use for that material is actually returning it to the soil and providing a soil amendment, which is what we choose to do. So we think that's a better use for that material.
Follow up?
Yep.
And just an observation, I appreciate your graph showing where the quantities and the the types of materials are going and how the progress has been made over the past number of years here and so forth. But I'm just guessing that, and you use words like public policy and social responsibility and so forth also, and I'm just guessing that in order for, it seems to me like the low-hanging fruit probably is gone in terms of recycling and so forth and reusing, but in order to get to the next level, you're going to need lawmakers at either this level or maybe another level to impose some sort of mandates requiring behaviors that currently aren't required. Is that correct?
oftentimes public policy that incentivizes or requires does help increase those types of recycling rates. Oftentimes at the local level, introducing programs that are voluntary pilot programs where the citizens get to choose whether or not they want to participate are also just as effective in terms of starting the ball rolling. But from our perspective, you know, having public policy to help incentivize and not necessarily punish people to do so is very helpful, increasing recycling rates, but not the only way to go about it.
I kind of like the term incentivizers instead of lawmakers. I think I'm going to christen that.
We'll have a bill on that. Yeah. Change our names. Good. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The challenge, to build on Vice Chair's point, the challenge is at what point does the cost of the recycling exceed the value of what you're about? So what do you have that shows us that at the end of the day, everything that you've done as you move up that ladder isn't more expensive than just finding a big space in, well, my district and stacking it up?
Recology's stance, as Amy had mentioned before, is always trying to find the highest and best use for those types of materials. And oftentimes what that means is sitting down with, if it is a rural community, sitting down with that community and seeing how much effort they do want to put into that to put those materials to their highest and best use. For us, that means recycling, composting, finding marketable products for that. And oftentimes, too, it means going into a partnership with that community so that they can see the benefits of those marketable products. So it doesn't just be collected from that community and then spent somewhere else. It's actually used within that community, which helps then decrease those ratepayer dollar for the extra services that are being provided, such as recycling and or composting.
I think that's the correct answer, because that would suggest that at that level there's been a decision by those folks that indeed the cost is less than the benefit. So it would seem that when you pass that, you would have to use the mandate, otherwise it will continue to work. Is that a correct thought?
Sometimes, yes. Sometimes a mandate would be necessary for more rural communities, but that's not necessarily the stance that we always like to take, because you want to empower the people to want to do that. So enable to do that means you find a happy medium or balance to which that community can see the benefits. Like I had mentioned, if you're making marketable products from compost or recyclables, that goes back into the community, because if it doesn't, then yes, the expense is much higher than many are willing to pay.
Thank you.
Thanks. Very briefly, and we have to move on, Representative.
I'm going through the bill here rather quickly, and
sorry, Representative, we're on an informational meeting. There isn't a bill associated with this.
So we're not on.
Oh, we'll have 2336 okay. After this. Thanks.
I'll hold off till then.
Great. Thank you very much. Appreciate
Thank
your
you.
Testimony.
Chair. Sure.
And I'd like to call up John McKinney, Columbia Biogas. Or somebody else from Columbia Biogas.
Okay. Chair Bailey, members of the committee, my name is Holly Sterncorp. I work with John McKinney. Unfortunately, he couldn't be here today, but sends his regards. I will be speaking about Columbia Biogas. If I can operate the... Columbia Biogas is a Portland-based company developing a world-class facility that will convert food waste into renewable power and organic fertilizer products. As Megan said, food waste is one of those last remaining items in the waste stream that there is interest in diverting, and this facility is designed to target commercial food waste. As I said, John McKinney is the owner and the developer of Columbia Biogas, and unfortunately, he wasn't able to attend. Columbia Biogas is an innovative renewable energy production facility. As I said, it will take commercial food waste and industrial food waste, so food waste from grocery stores, restaurants, food service establishments, breweries, bakeries, and turn it into renewable natural gas and fertilizer products. The facility will use a technology known as anaerobic digestion to convert the food waste into renewable energy. Anaerobic digestion is a well-known and proven technology that's used in wastewater treatment facilities as well as in a number of similar facilities in Europe. What John has done is he's really pulled together a best-in-class team to bring the best technology and people to the table to not only engineer the facility but also to operate the facility. One of the major benefits the facility will bring to the area are the jobs that it will create in the local community. The facility is located in the Cully neighborhood in northwest Portland. The Cully neighborhood historically has had the highest rate of diversity in Portland as well as the highest unemployment rate. We worked very closely with the neighbors from the beginning to develop a good neighbor agreement that's being held up as an example of how businesses should work with communities when they're bringing in a facility like this. Not only does a good neighbor agreement address odor, noise, traffic, kind of the typical issues, but there are also a number of community benefits that are associated with the good neighbor agreement. And one of those is bringing jobs to the neighborhood. We developed a subcommittee with the neighbors and a number of the community development corporations to develop job recruiting, training, and hiring programs, not only during construction, and we have a construction diversity specification with hiring goals for minority and women, but also the local community, as well as a hiring, training, and recruiting program for operations. And at the state level, the facility will continue to support the state's position as a national leader in sustainability as well as clean energy. As I said, the facility will take in, it's really focused on commercial and industrial food waste. So your grocery stores, restaurants, breweries, bakeries, difficult to manage wastes, and produce with those through an anaerobic digestion process, produce renewable natural gas, organic-based fertilizer products, and then the other byproduct is water. This is fairly common technology in Europe. There are a number of facilities throughout Europe. This graph shows the exponential growth in biogas production facilities. In fact, in Sweden, the biogas that's produced there is used to, in several towns, run their bus fleets, so taking in food waste to run buses. Remember the Back to the Future movie. In the U.S.
The second one.
Yeah. In the U.S., this technology is also starting to catch on. Mostly here, the technology is farm-based. There's a large digester in Tillamook. Also, Stablish Farms has an anaerobic digestion facility. One of the major differences with Columbia Biogas is that we'll be taking in food waste from businesses rather than just farm-based. The facility is located the Cully neighborhood. It's located right near the Portland Airport. One of the big benefits, and it's Columbia Boulevard, right near a number of I-5 and 205. One of the major benefits of the location is that it's close to where the food waste is generated. So rather than having to collect the food waste and haul it long distances, incurring that transportation cost as well as the greenhouse gas impacts, it's just being trucked a few miles to a local facility that will produce renewable power locally as well as the organic-based fertilizer products. This is the facility layout, and just kind of briefly walk you through it. That's Columbia Boulevard, and so the trucks pull in, and you'll see that back building if I had a little pointer off to the upper middle of the picture. That's the receiving and pretreatment building. One of the things you'll notice in this facility is it's all completely enclosed. Not only is it enclosed, but it is there's odor control. We're a quarter of a mile away from residents, so odor was a major issue. So in the design of the facility, that was a major consideration. So the food waste will come in, will go into a fully enclosed building under negative air pressure, odor controlled. The material is immediately processed, so within 24 hours it's process. There's no material sitting. And then it goes into those tanks, and anaerobic digestion is without air, so the food waste goes into those tanks, and microbes consume the food waste and produce biogas. Biogas is about 60% methane, and methane is what is our natural gas. So once the biogas is produced, it can either be used to run generator sets and produce electricity, or it can be conditioned and put directly into the natural gas pipeline. And that's what Columbia Biogas will be doing. It'll be upgrading the biogas to pipeline quality natural gas, and will be injected straight into the natural gas grid, and can be used just like any natural gas is used to heat our homes, cook food. One of the things that we'd like to do at Columbia Biogas, we put a lot of effort into it, is to get this renewable natural gas into the transportation market so it can be used as an alternative transportation fuel. There are a number of fleets close by that run compressed natural gas vehicles, garbage hauling companies, the port, their buses are run on natural gas. So this is a, that's our goal, is to have this renewable natural gas used for transportation and to help move that sector of alternative fuel forward. Here's a picture of the material we'll be able to take. So it's essentially all food waste, fruits, vegetables, food soiled paper, liquid waste. We'll be able to take a number of difficult to manage wastes, grease trap waste, a number of other things, and turn those into renewable power. One of the things that we aren't interested in is yard debris or garbage. The facility anaerobic digestion is a really great complement to the existing solid waste system, which includes composting facilities. There are a number of composting facilities in the Portland area that are currently taking yard debris, producing compost, as well as taking some food waste. What anaerobic digestion does is it really focuses on that commercial food waste, which can be a difficult to manage waste, process it, and capture the energy value out of that waste. So it provides more options for the material, stabilizing the solid waste system. So just briefly to wrap up, I think I've touched on most of these. The benefits of the facility, for one, we've got locally produced renewable energy made from local feedstock. Also supporting efforts to reduce long-term greenhouse gas emissions. And that comes really in two ways. One, as I said, the transportation. Rather than having to transport this food waste miles to a landfill or a remote composting facility, can be treated locally, as well as reducing the methane produced from the decomposition of the food waste. So rather than letting that methane release into the atmosphere, it's captured and turned into renewable power. Also, as I just stated, supporting the transition to cleaner transportation fuels, solid waste reduction, and as I covered, our commitment to the community through the Good Neighbor Agreement and the jobs creation. That is an overview of the facility, and open it up for any questions.
Senator, Representative Whitsitt.
Do you have a cost estimation of the renewable natural gas generated and the cost for compressed natural gas, as well as the cost of electricity that you're talking about?
I don't have the cost savings. It'll be producing 3 million diesel gallon equivalents of renewable natural gas. So as far as offsite, right now diesel is more expensive than compressed natural gas. So I don't have the data to put in, like, what the actual cost savings would be.
There's a couple. Yes. Are you going to take livestock rendering at all? I notice you're taking raw meat. We have a real need in the state for a rendering facility. We're shipping our livestock from southern Oregon to Seattle right now, and so our dead animals essentially have no place to go. So in Europe, they use animal as well as this other, and I was wondering if you are set up to do that.
We are planning on taking rendering. The only issue is when you get into the mad cow, just the parts of the animal that carry it, the prions, mad cow disease, which are the heads, the spinal cord. We at this point don't want to take that particular material, but the rest of the rendering, yes, that's yeah. So definitely.
Would it matter for fuel?
Well, it doesn't matter for fuel. What it matters for is what can be done with the digestate at the end. Once you take in those materials that have potentially have prions, the digestate, that product, has got to go to a landfill. If we're not taking in those materials, and it's the head, you know, it's a specific part of the animal, if we don't take that in, then the material can be turned into a high-value fertilizer product. So it's kind of the use of the end product.
Thanks.
Let me say, first of all, I'm pleased that you're going to deal with the odor issue, because my daughter lives less than a quarter of a mile from there. So, but I do know that the Cully Association of Neighbors is a very dynamic neighborhood association, and if there's any odor of odor, they will be on it. I have a question about why garbage can't be used. What exactly is the issue? You know, with food, you know, kitchen scraps. Why does that not work as well as other products?
The yard debris, or
didn't you say the kitchen scraps are also a problem?
No. We're taking it all, okay. All food waste. We're really mainly focused on commercial and industrial, because that is the largest quantity. On the residential side, we'd certainly be happy to take the residential food waste, but the way programs are evolving, like the city of Portland, right. They're mixing the food waste in with yard debris. The facility could take yard debris, but it's got a much lower gas yield than the food waste does. And also, there are there's composting infrastructure that can handle the yard waste. So,
But if at some point the city were interested in asking people to separate their yard debris from their kitchen waste, their food waste, you're very conveniently located.
Absolutely. We'd love to take it.
Thank you. Would you pay more than the composters do?
For the material?
Yes.
That often is left up to the city for the rate setting.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We appreciate it. Okay, I'm going to close the informational meeting. And before we open up the public hearing, I want to say on House Bill 2860, if anybody is here for that bill, given the number of people that have signed up to testify on 2336, it is highly likely that we will carry over House Bill 2860 to the next meeting. So if there's anybody that's here for that bill that cannot come back on Thursday for that, please send a note up to the dais and we will work you into the flow of this meeting. Okay, so 2860 likely to be held over. If you're here for that, can't come back, let me know. Thanks. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2336. Adam?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2336 requires the Environmental Quality Commission, or EQC, to adopt rules requiring permit applications to include an analysis of actions the facility may take to reduce toxic emissions. It also requires the EQC to develop the mechanism that when the Department of Environmental Quality receives a permit application, copies of that application are provided to governing bodies of local governments affected by the facility.
Representative Greenlick, would you care to kick us off?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm State Representative Mitch Greenlick, House District 33, Northwest Portland, out west into Washington County. And Mr. Crawford just gave my testimony, but I'll elaborate just a little bit. This bill comes to you after a very successful interaction between an industry and a neighborhood, and you're going to hear more about it in a minute, when ESCO's air quality permit came up, the neighborhood, for a variety of reasons, was quite concerned and got into an interaction that lasted, as I remember, more than 2 years. I was involved trying to help that a little bit, facilitate it, but it ended up with a good neighbor agreement between ESCO and the neighbors to do precisely what we're trying to do with this bill. DEQ operates in the permitting process under the Clean Air Act, under Title V of the Clean Air Act, operating from the federal government. And it operates within the federal government guidelines, except when we as a state legislature add assignments, add functions to that. And what we're doing here is proposing two modest functions that happen as DEQ deals with the Title V permits of in the future. One is essentially to say that the permitting process needs to include an analysis of action that the facility needs to take in order to reduce toxic air emissions. And the other is to send the application off to local governments, and you'll hear testimony from Multnomah County and others about how important that is, so that the local governments know how to react to the process. Right now, even in situations where the plants are producing air toxics, they don't have to, as a part of the process, necessarily talk about how they would take action to reduce that air toxin. This bill simply requires that as a part of the process, if they are producing air toxins, that they have a action plan to reduce those. Seems very simple and very straightforward. I think DEQ told me that they were going to be neutral on this bill, I think. But you'll hear from them directly, I expect. That's all I have to say. You'll hear some very compelling testimony from some of my constituents who've been very much involved in this process.
Thank you, Representative. Questions for the representative? Letting you off easy, sir.
Off easy.
All right. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And I'd like to call up Dick Peterson and just Dick. Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Dick Peterson, Director of Department of Environmental Quality. I'm here to provide you with some information about House Bill 2336, which would amend requirements for the Title V permit application. To clarify, Representative Greenlicht's statement, DEQ is not taking a position on the bill at this time. Because House Bill 2336 is directed at DEQ's Title V permitting program, I thought I'd take just a minute or two to provide a brief overview of that program and how it fits into DEQ's overall toxics reduction approach. Title V of the Clean Air Act requires every state to have an operating permit program for major sources of industrial pollution. The purpose of Title V is to ensure that companies operate in compliance with all applicable regulations. Federal law requires that permits include all the requirements that a source is subject to. DEQ's role is we're a delegated program under the Clean Air Act, and what we do is issue permits. And in that permit issuing responsibility, we provide opportunity for public comment associated with those permit actions. Title V itself applies to the largest individual sources of air pollution in the state. To trigger a Title V permit, this is what triggers a Title V permit. An entity has to emit more than 100 tons per year of a traditional pollutant such as particulate or volatile organic compounds. Or if it emits 10 tons or more per year of any one hazardous air pollutant, it would a hazardous air pollutant under EPA's definition would be an air toxic. That would trigger a Title V permit. Or if there's an emission of 25 tons per more a year of combined hazardous air pollutants, that would trigger Title V permitting. It is important to note that Title V permits include controls on air toxics that are part of the federal requirements for the permits. So nationally, EPA has listed 188 hazardous air pollutants and has adopted limits on the amount of air toxics that may be emitted from 160 different category sources of emitters, like foundries, pulp mills, facilities that paint manufactured products. That's just to name a few of the categories. So once EPA adopts an emission standard for those sources, then what DEQ is required to do is to adopt that standard, and we do so through rulemaking through our Environmental Quality Commission. So as a delegated state, we're responsible to take all the federal requirements and make sure all Title V permits are taken care of. In terms of what's the landscape in Oregon, DEQ, we've operated the program since 1994, and there's 111 Title V sources across the state, and it covers pretty much geographically the state. So while the federal approach of regulating air toxics from Title V sources has resulted in significant reduction in emissions from those sources through those controls, much of the toxic air pollution in Oregon comes from things like vehicles, engines, wood stoves, everyday activities of individuals and smaller businesses. So just very briefly, I'll just outline what DEQ's efforts are to look holistically at air toxics. Using stakeholder input, the EQC adopted the Air Toxics Program in 2003. The main goal of the program is to look comprehensively at air quality in geographic areas to determine if things can be done to reduce air toxics in those geographic airsheds from all sources, certainly prioritizing those toxics around most impactful toxics, highest level, and most impactful to public health. As the first step in implementing this program, EQC adopted benchmarks, not standards, but benchmarks of 51 air toxics that are prevalent in Oregon. This is based on recommendations from an Air Toxic Science Advisory Committee that we put together. So the benchmark serves both as sort of guidelines, if you will, to look at where we need to focus our energy, if you will, in reducing air toxics in Oregon. The first geographic area that we're looking at under this program is the Portland airshed itself. And so we identified 19 air toxics that were known or suspected to be of these above these benchmarks that I'd mentioned before. So together, working with a Portland Air Toxics Advisory Committee, DEQ developed an analysis and an understanding of air toxics problems and potential solutions in the Portland area, and are working on things like promoting cleaner wood-burning techniques and reducing residential wood smoke, which is a source of air toxics, transportation planning to reduce vehicle usage. Vehicles are a big source of air toxics, and diesel engine replacement and retrofitting, which controls diesel emissions from those facilities. So that's just a real quick overview of that. Now turning to House Bill 2336 and provide you DEQ's assessment of it currently. The scope of the bill would affect the Title V program and the 111 permittees that I had mentioned are under the Title V program before. As Representative Greenlich mentioned, Title V, there's two requirements in the bill. Title V permit applications must include an analysis of actions the facility could take to reduce air toxics emissions. And once DEQ has that analysis, we would send copies of the applications to local governments. And thinking about how we would need to implement the bill, we would likely have to modify our Title V rules through rulemaking to provide specifics about what that analysis would include and be submitted to us and how that information would be delivered. So the Title V sources would then have to submit the analysis of reduction actions in the applications to their permits, and then we would review those for completeness, like we do any application, and then once that determination was made, we would distribute a copy of the application to local governments affected by the permit. We would certainly incorporate the analysis of toxics reduction actions into the permit review report, which is part of the Title V permit, and certainly available to public during the public comment period of a Title V permit action. The bill does not require applicant companies to implement the actions in their toxics reduction program. It's just asks them to submit a reduction plan. Certainly, companies could choose to voluntarily implement the reduction actions. So with that, I'll finish my testimony and certainly be willing to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Representative Whitsitt.
Mr. Peterson, would Oregon's House Bill 2336 exceed the federal requirements of the EPA's stated requirements for enforcement of the Clean Air Act under the Title V sources? Would this, essentially, would this make it a stricter law than we have set by the federal standards?
Chair Bailey, Representative Whitsitt, what we'd have to do is add this on as a requirement. Certainly, it's not, it's as I stated earlier, it's not requiring companies to reduce their emissions, just providing a planning report. So in terms of strictness, it's an additional report that would be required in addition to what's required under the Title V permit program.
So the answer is yes?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
And Director Peterson, we're going to have you stay up here for a second. I think there are more questions from the committee for you, but we've been joined by our speaker, who I want to make sure we respect her time.
Sure.
And have her able to give her testimony.
There's room for
both. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I appreciate that, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, everyone. For the record, I'm Tina Kotek, State Representative from House District 44, North and Northeast Portland, and Speaker of the House. I'm here to speak in support of House Bill 2336 today. I have very broad comments, and I'll be brief. What I like about this bill is that it's an attempt to provide additional transparency in a process that's very, very important. Very important for business, very important for communities, very important for the state, and frankly, you know, the federal government and EPA requirements. What I like about it is, you know, there are some ongoing issues in my district around air quality permitting, and I think it's an attempt to say we just need more information, a little bit more transparency in the process, and an attempt to provide information in a timely manner so community members can weigh in. I don't believe this is an attempt to make the process harder, to make it more difficult on businesses. I understand there's a concern about that, that this is an attempt to increase regulation on businesses as they apply for their permits. I think there's a balance to be struck here in our permitting process. And I would ask that this committee have an open mind on this bill. I have had some sense of the business community's concerns here, but as someone who represents a community in North and Northeast Portland that lives side by side with industrial sites and neighbors who say, I want those businesses to stay there. We want those jobs, but we need a little bit more communication with those companies when they're up for their air permits, because we have some livability issues in our districts. This is asking for additional information. It's asking for some additional transparency in the process, and I think that's reasonable. So keep an upper mind. I would hope you could support this, potentially have a work group to resolve some issues. It's very important to my district and very important to people who live in North Portland. So thank you.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Questions? Representative Reardon.
Has anyone done research? Mr. Chair, has anyone done research on the cost, typical cost to the companies for conducting this additional research and providing this information?
Representative, we may be able to hear from advocates on this okay. who might have that information.
That'd be great.
Great. Thank you
Thank
very
you,
much.
Thanks for Thank you, time. Committee members.
Mr. Peterson, back on the hot seat. Representative Widener, I believe you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, just yeah. read the other, didn't I?
I wasn't going to say anything.
Yeah, wow. Well,
maybe I should just stop right here. So, maybe I should ask Speaker. Just looking at this, requiring that the permit application include analysis of actions that the facility may take to reduce air emissions. And after hearing from some of the industrial plants around here and watching a lot of paper mills being shut down, how hard would you think it would be right now for a new paper mill to site in the state of Oregon? I mean, how long would it take them, and what would the cost be involved just with the processing that's in place for them to open up a plant here, and how many requests have you had for that?
Chair Bailey, Representative Widener, I'm not aware of any request to open a new paper mill in Oregon. As far as the siting issues related to it, it depends a lot on where it's at. You know, land use issues associated with that. Our requirements would be to apply, you know, all requirements that we do for through normal permitting of air, water, and, you know, land issues that are associated with that, which we would work through. But certainly working with, you know, land use decisions is an important element of that. As to the cost of that, I don't have the answer to that.
I was just curious on the permitting process and what they'd have to go through, because worked with several paper mills that have been shut down,
mm-hmm.
Albany, Oregon City,
mm-hmm.
and they were looking at large fines from DEQ already in place with just their normal process. And I'm just wondering, you know, is this going to incentivize businesses that pay basically $70 an hour with benefits and everything to come here? Is this going to disincentivize them? And, I mean, do you have any of these companies of the 111 saying, oh, you're going too easy on us, or are you going too hard on us?
Chair Bailey, Representative Wiener, my answer to that is I think we've had a fairly ongoing open relationship with 111, and, you know, they understand the challenges that they're faced with when it comes to environmental regulations and have worked through it. A lot of facilities have reduced their emissions to fall below the Title V threshold, so the permitting requirements aren't as rigorous. That's been somewhat of a voluntary case. I think we've gone from 134 Title V permitted facilities to the 111 that I'm talking to now, and that's through working with facilities to help reduce emissions in a way that works for them. Certainly, I'm not aware of anyone coming to us and saying you're being stringent enough on us individually from the permitting perspective, but certainly concerns from local neighborhoods and others come into play when we write permits, and we try to address those in the way of a communication plan and working some of those issues out. But the permitting process is what it is.
I could, real quick, if you could get the information to me, I'd be curious on how many fines you issued to the 111 companies that are out there that fall under Title V and what those fines were.
Yep. Chair Bailey, Representative Wiedner, we'd be happy to do that.
It's actually Wiedner.
Wiedner, sorry. Apologize.
Representative Betts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The I think, Director, you said 105 companies would be affected by this. I think you gave us the number.
Chair Bailey, Representative Benz, there's 111 Title V.
I'm sorry,
permits, so it'd be 111.
111.
Yes.
And then the proposal says the provisions requiring the applications include, quote, an analysis of the actions that the facility may take. So I don't know what that means, may. Does that mean what they might do and the full scope of it, or what they are personally planning on doing and might get around to someday? Or I don't understand what may means. And then while you're answering that, the word analysis, in my very limited experience in this area, generally means hiring all kinds of help, usually very expensive help, from people that come in and provide that analysis. So perhaps you could share with us the cost,
mm-hmm.
and put that together with the may and give us a scope of what this would have without the rules yet written.
Right.
Is that a dig on consultants, Representative?
Yes, the modest one, yes.
Chair Bailey, Representative Dance, I'm sort of literally reading the bill since it's not a DEQ bill. So I would say on the may part, it means that companies may or may not, upon their choosing, implement the reduction options in the plan. I mean, and maybe the proponents of the bill could speak to that more. As far as what the analysis, specific analysis, would take, I think that's reserved for the rulemaking to clarify it, to really understand, okay, what would we need to meet the intent of the bill if it were passed by the legislature? I don't know at this point.
Thank you. Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Peterson, help me more understand a little bit more about these Title V permits, if you will. They've been in place since the imposition of the Federal Clean Air Act. Is that correct?
Chair Bailey, Vice Chair Johnson, that's correct.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And over the length of that time, have the criteria for issuance of permits remained the same, or have they modified slightly with time as
new criteria about air quality and so forth, or change and new regulations come into play. In other words, a permit today is different than a permit may have been 20 or 25 years ago. Is that correct?
Chair Bailey, Vice Chair Johnson, that's correct.
Okay, so there is a process in place, I guess, that regularly the agency gets to modify what's really happening in the real world, if you will, and determine what hoops, if you will, that the industry has to jump through in order to remain compliant. Is that correct?
Chair Bailey, Vice Chair Johnson, that's correct.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Thank you very much. Okay, and because of the time and the number of people that want to testify, I'm going to ask people who are testifying on both sides to keep their comments to 3 minutes, and I will have a timer. Call up Mary Pivido and Stacy Schroeder and Janice London Edgewood. Apologize if I got that wrong. Please.
Hello, my name is Mary Pivito. I'm a co-founder of Neighbors for Clean Air, and thank you very much, Chair Bailey and Vice Chair Johnson and Vice Chair Boone and all the committee members for allowing me to be here today to testify in support of House Bill 2336. In 2008, a study of schools and industry published by USA Today used an EPA model to track the path of industrial pollution to determine the levels of toxic chemicals outside of 128,000 schools in the United States. Researchers concluded the potential problems that emerged were, quote, widespread, insidious, and largely unaddressed. This landmark study illustrated that despite overall improvements in air quality since the 1970s, there still persisted dangerous levels of toxic chemicals, toxic emissions due to a significant blind spot of the Clean Air Act, toxic hotspots. In Portland, Oregon, I and my Northwest neighborhood parents were shocked to learn that close proximity to the industrial sanctuary, specifically the Title V regulated Esco Steel, put 7 neighborhood schools in the worst 2% of schools across the nation for industrial toxic pollution. We're told by DEQ that the company's emissions, which included a soup of heavy metals like manganese, arsenic, chromium, and over 70 other crazy-sounding chemicals, were all legal. This, despite the fact that the state's modeling and monitoring data showed that Portland's airshed contains 15 toxic compounds that exceeded health-based benchmarks by as much as 100 times. This problem is not limited to the Portland airshed. In the school and industry study, 117 Oregon schools ranked in the bottom 10%. No Portland school ranked better than the bottom 30%. From August 2009 through October 2011, I served as a citizen volunteer on the Portland Air Toxic Solutions Advisory Committee alongside some 30 other stakeholders that was charged with coming up with unanimous consensus recommendations to reduce these air toxics in Portland. Concurrently, Neighbors for Clean Air was engaged directly with Esco Steel in a protracted negotiation that culminated in the November 2011 Good Neighbor Agreement signed between neighborhood representatives and Esco Steel. This would result in a 20% reduction in heavy metal emissions from the company. Conversely, in August 2012, in the final report to the EQC, DEQ staff stated that the decade-long Portland Air Toxic Solutions program had been unable to come up with any recommendations for reductions in air toxics in the Portland airshed. Toxic pollution is a threat to public health. It costs our state significant money. Over 10% of the Oregon population suffers from asthma, which a 2008 study estimated the cost to the state at more than $28 million a year. The estimate of the total cost of environmentally attributable disease in Oregon for children alone is $1.10 billion annually. This includes treatment for asthma, cancer, cardiovascular disease, birth defects, lead poisoning, and neurobehavior problems, nearly all of which are linked to toxic air. This impact is underscored by the support for the bill by Multnomah County Chair Jeff Kogan, whose agency bears the burden of the state's highest asthma hospitalization rate. We can do better. We must do better. Our children deserve better, and they deserve more than hyperbole about job-killing regulations. Oregon needs common sense improvements in how industrial air polluters receive permits. Unlike non-industrial sources of toxic air pollution, our oldest and dirtiest industrial facilities still receive permits to emit the same level of emissions as they did in the 1970s. And no facility in Oregon is required to meet community health-based emissions limits. It's important to clarify what this bill is not about. It's not about shutting industry down or
Ms.
broad
Pluto,
application.
If you could wrap up your comments, that would be
okay,
great.
Okay, one-size-fits-all requirements. It's about creating a transparent and fair process that allows for serious consideration and mitigation of the impacts of industrial activity on the public. I appreciate your serious condition of House Bill 2336 today. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for your time. Please.
Representative Bailey and committee, good afternoon. My name is Stacy Schroeder and I live in North Portland on the bluff above Swan Island Industrial Park. I represent over 160 interested, concerned people in my neighborhood. Since moving to North Portland just over 4 years ago, my neighborhood has organized in response to smelling toxics that are leased about three blocks upwind from our homes, parks, and lives. We have tried to work with Daimler trucks over the daily paint fumes that we smell, and we've tried to work with DEQ, encouraging them to uphold Daimler's permit, in which it states that Daimler cannot be a nuisance to the surrounding neighbors. But with hundreds of odor complaints logged with DEQ in the past year, we are left wondering what else can we do. And it's not just nuisance that we're talking about. It's about breathing things like toluene, xylene, ethylene, benzene, methyl isobutyl, ketone, methanol, and chromium compounds, all of which are nasty, harmful things for us to be breathing. In the 2008 study of industrial emissions by USA Today, North Portland schools were found to be in the bottom 5% affected by industry emissions nationwide. There's 117 schools, like Mary mentioned, in Oregon. Half of them are in Portland. Half of them are in other places. Medford has quite a few, Pendleton, Eugene, Salem, some out at the coast. And DEQ's recent pollution modeling, which estimated pollutants from all sources, put health risk from air toxics in the census block next to Daimler's plant at roughly 100 times health benchmarks, with industry and solvent pollution making up 16% of the risk. So a lot of time has been taken up and has not produced any changes. So far trying to work with Daimler and DEQ in the past month, 15 months, has taken up a lot of time but has not produced any changes. Daimler and other industry have been grandfathered in under our current outdated 1970 standards without any impetus to change old ways of manufacturing. Daimler has told us we could do better, but why should we? We are operating within our permit. This bill would help identify potential changes that a company could make and use better, more up-to-date technology when releasing toxic emissions into our environments. We want our shared air to be as healthy and clean for everyone as possible, and I urge you to support it. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Representative Bailey, members of the committee. I'm also going to give my testimony of as being a North Portland neighborhood neighbor. The poor air quality that we experience in University Park is not what I thought I would be dealing with when I moved to Portland 8 years ago. The current air situation in the area...
Could you identify yourself for the record?
I'm sorry. My name is Janie Lundeen Ledgerwood, for the record. So I'm an avid cyclist, runner, and mother of two. Too often, we are bombarded by the fumes from the companies on Swan Island. I have experienced paint, solvent-type fumes, gaseous, sulfur, rotten egg odor. It permeates the entire household if a window or a door is left open. This happened just last week and daily, like I said. The experience with these fumes while running, walking, biking create a constant worry and nuisance. I want to emphasize nuisance here. Title V permits have a nuisance clause that requires them to take a closer look at the offending company. I don't believe this is being done. The smells are not a fleeting thing. They are a guaranteed daily occurrence and nuisance. According to the same study, you know, our schools are in the worst 5% in the airshed in the nation, and I believe this bill will help DEQ and other agencies enforce the nuisance clause that is contained within industrial permits. That's why I ask for your support in this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel committee? Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just need to know how the bill would help, because it appears it merely asks for the analysis and then provides for notice. So what is the thought? Is it that if the analysis is provided, something would then happen, or what's your thinking would happen next? Because this bill doesn't do more than create data.
Chair Bailey and Representative Benz, I'll take that question. In many ways, we replicated this bill off the process that we experienced with ESCO Steel, where an open, transparent, and independent analysis of the opportunities to reduce emissions was shared equally between the community and the company, and we were able to then make valued choices together about which priorities we could address. And that's, currently it's a very much of a closed door, so we're looking really for some sunshine on what currently industry neighbors may be able to say, hey, we're doing the best we can, that allows us to help be involved and engaged in that decision-making process. So it's really an opportunity for better, without us sitting at home Googling VOC emission reduction technology options, that allow us to understand what's feasible off the shelf, practicable for industry to do within their own specific unique facilities and processes to allow us to share in that decision-making.
Thank you.
And if I might build on Representative Benz's question, the bill itself refers to toxic air emissions. I'm not an air quality scientist. My understanding is that there are emissions that are toxic that you are difficult to detect. There are emissions that you can detect that aren't toxic. And so how is the decision made to go with toxic here, and how does that address some of the concerns that we've heard?
Chair Bailey, thank you. It is very difficult sometimes to separate all these different distinctions that I have, you know, regulatory distinction that often doesn't make much sense to us. In terms of the toxic emissions, I think generally most of the processes of reductions of emissions is going to sort of capture a wide berth of different types of toxic material or otherwise not toxic, but not everything that is toxic smells, and not everything that smells is toxic, but generally it's a marker, an indication of something that's coming out of the facility. It's an effluent from the production and activity at the facility. And so anything that can capture that, interestingly enough, with the Columbia Biogas, you know, it's fully covered. So it's, you know, it's not necessarily that everything smelly is going to be toxic, but when it's captured on site, it's going to capture both. So it may or may not be a distinction that's important in the ESCO process. We actually focused not on what smelled. We focused on what were the particulate matter and heavy metal emissions that is a different class than what is actually the odors produced from ESCO.
Thank you. Representative Dembrough.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Mary, so the bill calls for an analysis of actions. Who do you foresee doing that analysis?
I have always felt that the companies are in the best position to analyze their own business, either through their own knowledge and or through, you know, bringing in consultants. And that was what happened with ESCO. They brought in an outside consultant, actually volunteered to do that as part of the beginning negotiations and discussions with the community. So that was their choice. They felt like it was the best thing to do. And then they had the information that they wanted in terms of what was feasible and practicable at their facility.
Okay, just following up, I mean, do you foresee a challenge with the analysis perhaps not being objective? I mean, you had said that what you're looking for here is an objective analysis, but if the company is doing it, you know, themselves, there could be a perception that it's not objective. How would you get around that?
Thank you, Chair Bailey and Representative Dembrough, for, you know, frankly, I mean, at a certain point you have to trust, but we, again, you know, there is a certain standard and professional standard that a company is going to use to get the best information. And I, again, feel like they're in the best position to understand and know the intricacies of their own business, and that that open transparency of that process is kind of ground truths its reliability quite well.
Thank you. I appreciate that approach. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Vega Peterson.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for your testimony. Do you have any idea how much it cost ESCO to do this third-party analysis of their emissions?
Thank you, Chair Bailey and Representative Vega Peterson. No, we don't. That was not something that they disclosed in our conversations. We do understand that they did take on a independent third-party contract to do that. So, no, we were not disclosed at what cost.
Vice Chair Johns.
Yeah, thank you very much. I appreciate you being here today. The information that I have or the research that I've been able to do talks about kind of a collaborative process, I guess, if you will, between the Neighborhood Association and ESCO. And it seems at the end of the process, I don't know if you feel like you're at the end of that yet, but that there was kind of a good faith conclusion, if you will, that ESCO was going to do this, and in return for that, that you all will kind of agree to monitor and work together. Is that kind of an accurate depiction of what the situation currently exists in your neighborhood?
Chair Bailey and Vice Chair Johnson, yes. I mean, I think what it did is, you know, if you will, we had a contract for engagement moving forward, and it gave us some really clear parameters to that so that there wasn't sort of a constant slippery slope and constant, you know, re-asking and asking for more. So I think that the current, we're in the process of executing the actions that they agreed to. We signed a contract, you know, November 2011 that was very clearly laid out what they would do. And, you know, we have quarterly meetings through a neighborhood advisory committee that, you know, tracks that process. And it's actually, I think, been extremely beneficial and has opened and created a very good and clear communication about exactly what the expectations and how they'll be fulfilled.
Follow up, please.
Yep.
And then I think in your testimony, you mentioned some other companies in addition to ESCO that you felt were emitting odors, chemicals, whatever. Do you know whether they're covered by Title V permits or not?
Down on Swan Island, I think they're just two that have the Title V for air emissions. So Vigor Industries would be the other one down there.
So there could be companies there that aren't necessarily covered by that.
Right.
They could just have another business operation that just has...
Well, they have lower amounts where they don't have a Title V permit. So we definitely in our neighborhood smell other things. There's definitely paint fumes on an almost daily basis. And because Daimler's permit has been up, we've been trying to work with them, and so far haven't made any advances in that.
One final.
Yep.
Has the commercial usage in that area changed much over the past numbers of years? There's always kind of been an industrial presence in that Swan Island area, hasn't there?
I have lived in Portland 20 years, but only in North Portland, right on the bluff above Swan Island, for about 4 years. When I moved there, I assumed that things like emissions were being better monitored and that I wouldn't be moving to a place where I was smelling, you know, things like paint fumes and natural gas type smells on an almost daily basis.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Call up John Ledger, Tom Wood, Laura Luchek, and Kathy Von Nada in whichever order you would like. If that's your testimony, we'd ask you to keep it to 3 minutes, please. Great. Thanks.
I can do it in 3 minutes.
Yeah. Thanks.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm John Ledger, Associated Oregon Industries, and in the interest of time, I'm kind of deputized by other groups, including American Forest and Paper Association, Northwest Food Processors, Oregon Metals, Oregon Refuse and Recycling, and Portland Business Alliance. I'm going to talk really briefly. You've heard some about Title V facilities, and you're being passed out a list of all the Title V facilities. You can see a lot of them are wood products. Some of them are energy transmission. These would all get caught up in this. They're scattered around the state. Title V is a very rigorous process. They look at a facility as a group. They pick the top 12 performing facilities, top 12% in the whole nation, and then everybody has to come up to that standard and retrofit. And then after that, they do a residual risk analysis to make sure that's safe. On top of that, you have to meet NESHAPs, which is National Emission Standards for Hazardous Air Pollutants. If you modify your facility a lot or build a new one, you have new source review, which is so strict you probably cannot meet it, which is why they will never build a coal plant in this country again. And then on top of that, you have the local standards, which we have in Oregon. What is being proposed here kind of came out from a process that's been going on for many years with a lot of stakeholders. It came up in the stakeholder group. It wasn't selected by the agency as part of the process to go forward. It was presented to the EQC in hearings, public hearings. It was not selected by the EQC, and here is why. The state has a process through their toxics control strategies, the Portland, which is in Portland is the model, to look at the whole array of toxics by categories. And right now, industrial sources are in the eighth lowest category, behind wood stoves, even lawn and garden equipment. But they also have a process, and full authority, and they will do this, is where there are hot spots or things that need to be addressed. That's what they focus on. And that's what they're going to deal with, and that is the DEQ plan on how they're going to approach toxics. So things get addressed as they need to be addressed within a local community or a system. This has been a long process. It's still ongoing. And I think the other piece of this is, frankly, gets tied to odors, as you've heard. And I can understand that, and it gets wrapped into the whole nuisance process. And it's my understanding that the DEQ is going to put into kind of a fast track, kind of a big task force to look at how they're going to handle nuisance complaints. And nuisance complaints, odors, paint, whatever, they're not isolated to Title V at all. They're everything from compost piles to coffee roasting to everything you can imagine. So the two pieces of this, which is emissions, which you have high controls on, and the agency has a plan to deal with them on the industrial side as needed, is being dealt with. The other piece of this, which is dealing with nuisances, which is hard, they're going to be dealing with that. So I think when you look at this, I don't think this is something that's being addressed. This is simply a bill that is not needed. Now, I have with me Tom Wood, who is with Stoll Reeves, and he is an air attorney, has been for many years, and he's going to give you just a quick overview of some kind of things from the state perspective, and I think he can also address some cost information.
Thank you. Mr. Wood.
Thank you, Tom. Chair Bailey, members of the committee, my name is Tom Wood. I am a partner, as John said, at the Stoll Reeves Law Firm, where I actually represent a large number of those Title V sources on the list in front of you. I'm also an adjunct professor at Lewis and Clark Law School, where I teach the Clean Air Act, and I am chair of the Air and Energy Committee for Associated Oregon Industries. So I come at this from a bunch of different perspectives. I was also part of a process, a really great process that Oregon started, the DEQ instituted a number of years ago, in response to a concern that was raised by the environmental groups that there was a gap in the regulatory world, and that they said that there's this gap between what the U.S. government is doing and what the state is doing on air toxics. So they convened a large group of people that were government people, they were environmental groups, they were industrial representatives, and they came up with a solution to this. It was a true Oregon solution sort of approach. The foundational element on that everyone agreed to was, we don't want a program like some states where you're required just to do process for the sake of doing process. Everyone agreed that if you identified a problem, that source could get targeted and it could get fixed. So they came up with three different programs, all of which gave authority to DEQ. One to be able to regulate across source categories if you found a problem source category. One was to be able to regulate across geographic areas, and you've heard some of that already. Portland's an area there. And then the third is a hotspots authority, so that they identify one single source that's a real problem, They can specifically target a regulation at that single source. And that was the program that was adopted by the EQC and that DEQ has full authority for now. So there's no need to add something on. And to the extent this bill says everybody just goes through a regulatory process for the sake of process, it undercuts the foundational element of that program, what everyone agreed to. I can tell you from representing the sources who would be captured by this, the cost is considerable. I mean, a typical source, I was at a facility this morning, they have 200 different emission points, I asked them. Under this bill, they would have to hire someone to come in and assess individually each of those 200 and come up with what they call a best available control technology analysis, which is a term of art in my world. And, you know, if you got a really good deal, kind of a bulk volume discount, maybe $1,000 per point. So you're looking at $200,000 for that facility every 5 years, when that facility is already subject to a slew of federal regulations that go specifically to air toxics and that have been evaluated, as John said, not only as to what is the most advanced technology that you can apply, but also making sure that there's no residual health risk after that technology is applied.
You can wrap up your comments.
I
great.
So I believe that this just is a solution in search of a problem. I think we already have a program in place, and I urge you to oppose. Thank you.
Chair Bailey, members of the Energy and Environment Committee, thank you for allowing me to address you today. I'm Lauren Luchek, president of Miles Fiberglass and Composites. We are a 50-year-old family business that manufactures composite component parts for the RV industry, refrigerated well car, wind turbine components, wastewater treatment tanks, and we manufacture the parts for the Portland streetcar prototype. Those are just a few of our products. We have 70 employees with two facilities, which means we have...
If you move back from the microphone, it'll distort less. Thank you.
Which means we have two Title V permits. This book is one of 8 books I use to comply with our 2 permits. Through stringent reporting, EPA monitors us monthly, semi-annually, and annually. We are monitored on a styrene emissions, which is a hazardous air pollutant, or a HAP. The HAP styrene and has been the HAP of styrene has been around and studied for 60 years for health effects and has shown not to be a hazard for health. We are regulated on the amount we emit, what kind of materials we can use, hours we can operate, and our renewals are open for public comment. We are inspected by DEQ annually to make sure we are complying with our permit. We have been talking with a very large wind turbine company that is looking for a manufacturer to produce composite parts for a new innovative wind turbine. They currently are located in California for an assembly facility and are asking us to move down there to produce the parts down there. I have asked them to come up to Oregon. They are here today at our facility because I have told them Oregon is business friendly and we already have a permit here. Unfortunately, I'm missing that meeting today to be here because I think this is important. Bottom line is this would be a deal breaker for them, and not only for them, but many companies looking to come to Oregon. The governor is spending money on recruiting businesses here, and this would drive them away. Being more stringent than any other state will put Oregon at a competitive disadvantage. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Questions for this panel?
Just a quick...
Mr.
Wood, thank you for being here. Could you kind of briefly just summarize the evolution of the Title V permit process over the last few years, what you've seen in terms of how it might have been 20 or 30 years ago to what it now is encapsulated in these books?
The Title V program is a fairly recent program in Oregon. The last round of applications went in 1995, and DEQ started issuing permits around that time period. So you're talking about a program that's only been around for 17, 18 years. Some facilities just got their Title V permit 5-10 years ago, and so we're just looking at a first or second renewal cycle for that permit. The permits have gotten, though, the process has changed, really starting with the Boardman facility in Oregon, where it used to be renewals were fairly regular processes. You just came through, DEQ checked to see if the requirements were the same, and if all the requirements were in the permit, they'd renew it. because that's the purpose of the Title V permit. Starting with the Boardman facility, various folks came in and said, this is our opportunity to just kind of create questions around facilities and try and get new requirements in there, which specifically is not what was intended by Title V. Title V was intended to pull all the existing requirements together, not to create any sort of new requirements. So I'd say the primary change has been demands of DEQ that they change the nature of that process to be able to make it a permit whereby you create new requirements rather than being a warehouse where you put existing requirements.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And I apologize, we have one more member of this panel who I didn't give a chance to testify, so if somebody wants to swap out the question. Thank you.
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, Catherine Venata, Director of Government and Regulatory Affairs for the Northwest Pulp and Paper Association for the last 18 years. NWPPA holds six of those. Our members hold six of those 111 permits you saw. We used to hold more. As Representative Wiener so politely pointed out to me today, and I had a little... I want you to know that we all agree with the prior speakers on the panel to keep it short. The Title V program, I only wish my members just had eight of these binders and we only had 200 emission points within one of our facilities, because they are much larger and much more complicated than that. We want to provide jobs in Oregon. We want to be competitive, and we want to be competitive for other states and within our companies to other parts of the country that wouldn't have the same requirements. Therefore, we would ask that you would carefully consider adding new requirements to operate in Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I have a question. As I read the bill, I'm not convinced that the bill actually does all that much. The two operative sentences are provisions requiring that permit applications include an analysis of actions that the facility, as Representative Benz pointed out, may take to reduce toxic air emissions. So can you talk a little bit about what burden the actual bill puts on the process? Because I'm still not clear on that.
Okay. I see, thank you, Chair Bailey, I see two primary problems that come out of it. One of them I mentioned already is the cost of preparing an analysis. It is a significant burden for a facility to go through, analyze every point across the company, and do so in a manner that they can come forward as part of the Title V permit renewal process, where someone at the facility has to actually sign onto a statement that says everything in here is accurate to the best of my belief, and I can go to jail if it's not. That's a very high burden. They have to spend a lot of time and money to make sure that that renewal, and including this analysis, is full and complete and accurate. So it's just time, cost, and burden on that. My other concern is that once that is turned in as part of the Title V renewal application, it then becomes a lightning rod for people to be able to challenge the renewal of the Title V permit, because anyone could then come forward and say, I disagree. I think on point 199 out of 200, you actually didn't fully assess all the options. That now becomes a permit appeal point for that source and creates even more time and more angst around the permitting process. So those are the two concerns I see with it. Catherine?
Thank you, Tom. Chair Bailey, members of the committees, I would add that to what a pulp mill would do in a situation is that we would do an engineering analysis. We would hire engineers to look at all that. We would have to do a technology assessment of the technologies out there. And right now, there are new air standards on boilers coming down from the federal government that we will be installing in the next 3 years. So we would have to pick a point in time to do that. It would become very confusing about at what point in time would you like the analysis to be completed. And so it would just add regulatory uncertainty. I might add that we're looking at multi-millions of dollars to put controls on boilers at our facilities in the state, and there's some folks that aren't Title V facilities that will be facing those costs, and that the boiler controls do reduce the amount of hazardous air pollutants and air toxics that are emitted.
Thank you. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Speaker Bailey. Just real quick, one of the concerns I have, because I just went through this actually even building a new home, trying to build a green home, I watched the bar move. Wondering on Title V, when you've started some of these projects or putting in a new boiler, have you seen them move the regulation after you've ordered the equipment and had to make substantial changes that cost money to a project or a new plant being installed, or if you've heard anything like that?
Representative Widener, absolutely. I mean, that is a very common experience to have the kind of goalposts moved on you as you're going through the whole process. An example that Catherine brought up was the idea of the boiler air toxic standards. If you have started into a process but you haven't yet commenced construction and they change the rules, even just as a proposed rule, so you don't even know what the final rule will be coming out of EPA, you have to comply now with the proposal. And if that proposal then changes in the final rule, you have to then change and then comply with the final rule. So you're dealing with a constantly changing world of standards out there.
Thank you.
Any follow-up?
Very briefly. We have okay. Two more panels to get through.
Would this bill being implemented here, would it allow one more outside a group who may look at technology today and see something coming down the pipe be able to throw a hindrance in the process by I'm Joe Citizen and this technology could help you improve your air quality and maybe slow a project down even by itself?
Chair Bailey, Representative Widener, I believe absolutely that is a concern, that someone can raise the fact that you have identified through this analysis a particular control option and say, now I want to see that control option implemented. I mean, there's a reason that there's this process is being asked for, and that's to be able to then try and force companies to be able to implement that technology.
Representative Vega Peterson.
But there's nothing in the bill that actually makes a company have to apply by those that analysis, correct?
That is correct, Representative Vega Peterson. There is nothing that requires you to implement the technology. You have to go through the analysis of the technology and then prove to the department, in order for the department to issue the renewal, that it's a full and complete analysis. And that's the challenge point. But there's obviously an intent to also be able to say, let's try and urge people to move in that direction on controls.
Representative Reardon.
For your company, how many source points are there, and can you try to give me an idea of what the cost impact and would be on your organization?
We have four, and I've talked to somebody who does some of the analysis. It would be somewhere between 15,000 to 20,000 for the analysis per location. We have two locations.
So total of 30.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And the next panel will be Adam Bantle, Lisa Manning, and Sherry Vaccarella. While you're coming up, we have to do one quick procedural thing so we can hold 2860 over. So I'm going to temporarily close the public hearing on House Bill 2336, open public hearing on House Bill 2860 for the purposes of informing the general public and our large listening audience that we will be holding it over until Thursday, and close the public hearing on House Bill 2860 and reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2336. Please.
Hi, my name is Lisa Manning, Chair Bailey and members of the committee. Our neighbors have been working, let me start at the beginning. When we bought our house on North Wellesley Avenue 20 years ago, we asked the owner if there were any problems with stinky air. He said no, there wasn't. And then about 6 months later in the winter, we discovered that we were misinformed. And my husband and I have been working to try to, you know, remedy the situation, it seems like, for years. And I don't want to spend a whole lot of time talking about, but I just want to ask members of the committee, would you buy a house if you knew the air was stinky and there were toxic fumes in the air? Would you buy a house? I don't think you would. So I just urge you to really consider this is really important to us. We don't want to have to leave our homes. We were told at one time by the DEQ that we probably should just move out of the neighborhood, but we really love our neighborhood and we'd like to stay there. So we feel like this is a positive step forward that I hope that it may not be a well-written bill right now, but I think we need to start somewhere to remedy a situation that is endangering future generations in not only Portland but the rest of the state. So thank you for listening to us and considering our sincere concerns. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay. I'm Sherry Vaccarella. I live in the same neighborhood. And the air we breathe speaks to the very heart of the quality of life that we lead. My family's very fortunate to live in this lovely Portland neighborhood, a place with neatly planted gardens and bird feeders hanging from low branches. And there are a number of factors that brought us here to Oregon 3 years ago, not the least of which was the national reputation for environmental stewardship. We wanted to be in a place where children could grow healthy and strong, supported physically and spiritually by the spectacular beauty and resources of the Northwest. Little did we suspect that our new home just above the Willamette River would be served by schools that rank among the most polluted in the nation. In addition, the air frequently smells of gas and chemicals as I run through the neighborhood. It's a ready reminder that Oregon legislation and the DEQ have not responded to the technological improvements in air filtering with up-to-date environmental standards. Please bring Oregon back to the forefront of respect for the environment. This legislation is a valuable step in improving the quality of air in Oregon, and I urge you to support it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Bailey and committee, my name is Adam Bartel. I am also a neighbor in the University Park Neighborhood Association, or neighbor. I'm going to be frank and very brief. We bought our house about a year and a half ago, and as soon as fall got there, we bought it in the summer. We experienced the exact same air quality issues. And the fact that I'm here today is because the situation and the process that we went through to try and mitigate the problem with what we deemed the source has failed. We've had a number of meetings with Daimler Industries to try and provide some way forward through a good neighbor agreement. And while I'm sitting here, I've heard two different representatives from two different industries say that they had set out to try and put a good neighbor agreement in place, and that was actually happening. We have run into nothing but stone walls in this process. My hope is that House Bill 2336 will be a positive step forward and will initiate a more robust discussion about air quality. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Thank you very much for your time. And our last panel, Maggie Sullivan and John Krallman, please.
Good afternoon. My name is Maggie Sullivan. I'm one of the neighbors who live above Swan Island in Portland. I would just like to offer a little bit of brief anecdotal experience. There are three large companies on Swan Island. You've already heard that Daimler is one of the bigger ones and it's closest to us. Daimler emits paints and solvents odors into our air. The second one is Vigor Marine, which is an enormous company that does barge building and repair. They put off a lot of welding toxins into the air and a number of other activities that come from that company. There's five separate industries there. And the Port of Portland, during the winter months, keeps its dredger in port. And
the crew become the maintenance staff during the winter months, and so the diesel engines on that dredger are running 24/7. Those are two large diesel engines, and you can smell that diesel coming into our airshed during when the wind blows up onto our into our neighborhood. My anecdote is that I'm an older person now. I have been in extremely good health all of my life, and last year I contracted 4 severe colds. It was the same window of time that Daimler added a second shift to its schedule. And so we had, instead of 8 hours or 9 hours, we had all except the sleeping hours of the day, we had paint fumes coming into our neighborhood. I can't help but think that that coincidence is not a coincidence, that I became much sicker after being a very, very healthy person. All of a sudden, I get numerous colds a year. I also today Googled the effects of air pollution on animals and found just an enormous amount of information I couldn't even begin to digest. And there is also correlation with our animals, and so I kind of would like to speak in support of the cats and the dogs and the birds that are in our neighborhood. I even noticed last year that we had fewer hummingbirds at the feeder. There's just small things that you notice like that. I think that the animals that are our friends and our little neighbors in the trees need the clean air just as much as we do. In conclusion, I just hope that this bill, HB 2336, is a step toward cleaner air. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is John Krollman. I'm the staff attorney for Neighbors for Clean Air. I hope to be able to give you an overview of why we feel the current set of regulations is insufficient to tackle our toxic air pollution problem and answer any questions you have. As Mary pointed out, toxic air pollution is a big problem in Oregon, especially in our urban areas like Portland, Salem, Eugene, Springfield, and Medford. At the current point, with due respect to Director Peterson and Tom Wood, there is no comprehensive approach to regulating air toxins for health, both at the federal level and at the state level. At the federal level, there are industrial standards that can be quite strict. However, these only target specific industries and only target the very largest sources. For instance, ESCO Steel, which DEQ noted was the most significant source of heavy metals in the Northwest neighborhood in Portland, was not subject to the most strict requirements of these federal standards. Basically, all they were required to do was limit mercury scrap from their scrap materials. They didn't have to add any additional controls, just administrative controls. At the state level, Oregon is one of the few dozen or so states that have additional programs that are above and beyond what the federal program requires. However, an article by Professor Victor Flatt in analyzing these state programs found that Oregon's was by far the one of the weakest of these programs, on par with Louisiana's. While Oregon's program is broader in a certain sense in that it regulates non-industrial sources, it is both shallower and weaker. There are no enforceable standards under Oregon's program. The benchmarks that were mentioned before are not enforceable. Portland is violating 19 of these benchmarks, which means that there is an unreasonable risk of cancer in these neighborhoods. But there's no consequence to this. This was supposed to be addressed through actions such as the geographic program or the Portland Air Toxic Solution. However, after a decade, nothing came from this program. There were no concrete recommendations from the PATSAC committee to the EQC, to DEQ. Instead, we got a list of priorities for targets that DEQ could use its other authorities to try and address. However, at present, there are no additional reductions necessary in the Portland airshed to meet the National Ambient Air Quality Standards, And so this limits DEQ's ability to use these other authorities to get co-benefits in toxic reductions. This bill is aimed at trying to provide transparency and sunlight to the process, to allow communities to engage with these sources, to better understand how they may be able to reduce toxins. We understand some of the concerns that industry has. We believe that a lot of those concerns may be able to be solved at the rulemaking process by limiting the necessary scope of an analysis so that it only needs to be a reasonable analysis or some other standard. But the main point of this is trying to get as much of this information out there as possible. Some of these facilities are incredibly old and haven't really been upgraded at all. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You nailed that 3 minutes right on the Questions for this panel. Representative Widener.
Just a quick one here, since we have an attorney up here, and you may have been involved or may not have, but does the state and city, do they not have actions that they can take? Because we did take action against Freightliner when they had their spill, and I know Hardy Meyer's had a lawsuit pending against them for a long time and dealt with them, and that should have helped with some of the air pollution and some of the smells that were coming, because they're not here any longer. I mean, we dealt with them and handled them. Couldn't the state do the same thing to Daimler or somebody else?
Chair Bailey, Representative Widener, as long as the facility is meeting the requirements of its permit, there's very little that the state can do. Now, Neighbors for Clean Air believes that there is a lot of nuisance authority that the state could use, but hasn't, as of this point, been willing to engage in. But outside of that authority, because Daimler is meeting the requirements, the federal requirements and the state requirements at the moment, there's nothing that the state can really do to step in and require additional reductions. Despite what Tom Wood has said about people using the Title V process to try and demand additional reductions, if it's not required under federal regulations or state regulations, DEQ in the response to comments simply says it's not required, we can't require the facility to do this, and that's the end of that comment. So is that answering your question, I hope?
Yeah, I was just kind of curious because, I mean, you had Freightliner who met all their cleanup proceedings, but the state still kept a lawsuit going after them for millions of dollars until they eventually got ran out of the state, which that should help because it's one more manufacturer off the island with paint fumes and things like that.
Well,
I'm just wondering, could the state go forward and do the same thing to Daimler and run them off the island?
Well, to begin with, Freightliner is Daimler. It's just a change in corporate name. So that is the same structure, same building, same company, as far as I know, that's still operating there. As far as spill cleanups, that's sort of the penalty phase of things as opposed to the requirements, where there's sort of the it's the stick of environmental regulations, so that the reason why companies go out of their way to spend a lot of money to try and comply with regulations is because if they don't and they violate those regulations, they're going to get hit with penalties. And so that's the stick that kind of pushes companies to spend this money on compliance costs. But because Daimler at this point is, and many other companies, most of these Title V sources that I know of, aren't in violation of any clear standards, they're not under that kind of threat right now.
Mr. Coleman, you made a statement that the state has a lot of authority around nuisance that it's choosing not to use. As a follow-up to this hearing, could you provide the committee an analysis of what you think the tools are that are out there that the state is not using?
Chair Bailey, I would be happy to do that. There are clear regulations, and I think DEQ recognizes that and has started to put that as a priority to address those, but I would be happy to send this committee an analysis of that authority that DEQ has right now.
Thank you. Okay, thank you both very much. We appreciate your testimony. Thank you to all the people that traveled to get here today. We appreciate your time and your participation in the legislature. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2336. Committee is adjourned.